Today in Studio 360, deadlines come and go, and come and go, and come and go, and that's okay.
A lot of productive procrastination is putting off something that's complex, not because you're avoiding it, but because you haven't figured it out yet.
Why procrastination can be a good thing. Plus, what happens when your creative partner disappears?
It's taken this whole time for me to stop asking that question. What would he do here?
I'm Kurt Anderson, and this hour, cautionary tales and expert advice on how to complete creative projects. The art of finishing, especially the finishing of art, on Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. But to start the show, about a decade ago, I was writing my novel Heyday, which is set in the 19th century. I'd had one of my characters use the word deadline, so I needed to check to see if that word was actually in use in 1848. Turns out it wasn't. Deadline didn't become common until the Civil War, when it meant an actual line around a stockade, so that when any prisoner crossed the line, a rifleman would shoot them dead. Deadlines. Now I'm working on a new nonfiction book. It's a strange history of America. I had a contractual deadline 9 months ago. And then my very nice publisher gave me another deadline 3 months ago. And now I'm going to take a few weeks off from the show so I can actually finally finish the thing.
To begin, how to start? I'm hungry. I should get coffee. Coffee would help me think.
That is Nicolas Cage in the movie Adaptation.
But I should write something first, then reward myself with coffee. Coffee and a muffin. Okay. So I need to establish the themes. Maybe banana nut. That's a good muffin.
Adaptation is probably the most meta film ever made. Nicolas Cage plays the screenwriter, Charlie Kaufman, who wrote the screenplay for this movie. And the movie is the story of how Kaufman struggled to write a screenplay based on a book by Susan Orlean, The Orchid Thief. Speaking of meta, Susan is a friend of mine, and I believe she's also trying to finish writing a book right now. Hello, Susan. Anyhow, Adaptation is about a nightmarish case of writer's block. Writing is almost never easy, but I've got to say, for me, I think writer's block is rare and maybe kind of a misnomer. For me, the hardest part of any big writing project isn't getting started. It's finding my way to an end that satisfies me, finishing. It's that sense of being a pilot circling the airport and circling the airport and circling the airport and wondering if a runway is ever going to open up or if I might run out of fuel before I can land. The writer William Styron had that problem badly. Styron published four big novels in the 50s and 60s and 70s, including the bestsellers The Confessions of Nat Turner, got a Pulitzer for that, and Sophie's Choice. But then, for the last 25 years of his life, he struggled with alcoholism and depression and did not publish another novel.
Certainly, the most shocking thing was finding not one unfinished novel that he'd struggled with, and I knew he'd struggled with, but four or five.
That's Alexandra Styron, his daughter. Back in 2011, she was working on a memoir about her father. She told me about how she went to Duke University, where all her dad's archives are kept.
And there were these, you know, this wealth of manuscripts down there that were all in a sort of terrible mess.
And weirdly, chaotically numbered and arranged.
Yeah. I mean, they were sort of a metaphor for his troubled mind. And I didn't realize how hard he had tried to pull out of his soul another great novel, and that was his life's work, and that's what he couldn't make happen in the last 25 years of his life.
He wasn't just not writing.
Yeah.
He was failing to write up to
Yeah, he was failing to write in a way that was epic and tragic,
right,
and devastating.
Novels are filled with make-believe people, but they're written by real people, individuals sitting alone in a room. And if you spend enough time alone in that room, what's in your head and what's real can start getting blurry. And that can get weird.
Oh, come on, hon. Don't be so grouchy.
I'm not being grouchy. I just want to finish my work.
Jack Nicholson, of course, plays the writer in The Shining, the movie by Stanley Kubrick. Shelley Duvall plays his wife.
I'll come back later on with a couple of sandwiches for you, and maybe you'll let me read something then.
Wendy, let me explain something to you. Whenever you come in here and interrupt me, you're breaking my concentration. You're distracting me, and it will then take me time to get back to where I was. Understand?
Yeah.
Fine. And we're going to make a new rule. Whenever I'm in here, you hear me typing. Whether you don't hear me typing, whether the f*** you hear me doing in here, when I'm in here, that means that I am working. That means don't come in. How do you think you can handle that?
What Jack Nicholson is typing, it turns out, is the same line over and over again for hundreds of pages. All work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. In other words, it can be hard to keep your head screwed on straight when you're trying to make art.
I mean, I could sort of tell at the beginning that I was launching into something that I couldn't really see the end of.
That's the playwright Tony Kushner. For him, some plays never seem to be quite finished. When we spoke in 2005, he told me that in the 4 years since his play Homebody Cobble first opened, he'd rewritten it 17 times already.
It was trying to pull together two very, very disparate ideas, storylines, thematic elements, and that doing that was going to be very hard, and it was a huge gamble in the first place, and I could kind of feel that it was going to be one of those plays that you could just spend the rest of your life desperately trying to get right.
When paintings and sculptures leave the studio, or an album is recorded and released, or a book is sent out into the world, it's mostly pointless for those artists to anguish about whether the work is really done. But for playwrights, whose work can be revised really every time it's produced or performed, things are different.
There are 9 versions or something of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof and film versions of them. And you sort of go and you pick and you choose and you cut and you paste. We've certainly done that with Shakespeare. I mean, we have an anxiety about text. It's probably because of the Bible. It's supposed to be our guarantor that God exists and is a fixity in eternity and that life is not this endless flux, but life is an endless flux and we're fluxed. And text itself comes and goes and changes all the time.
We are fluxed. Not finishing when you want to finish isn't always a result of paralysis or perfectionism or any other inner turmoil. Sometimes it's the outside world that doesn't cooperate, especially in show business. I'm part of this team that's been working on a Broadway musical about Harry Houdini for, I think, 12 years now. Writers and composers come and go. A big star came and went. Stuff happens. In 2000, the director Terry Gilliam began filming a movie in Spain based on Don Quixote. And it was a fiasco. First, a monsoon swept in and destroyed equipment. Then financiers started to freak out. And the great horseman actor playing Quixote injured his back and couldn't saddle up on his horse, which was a big problem for this film.
Okay, we've stopped shooting, and nothing is happening. Nothing is happening.
We're running around in circles, and we're going...
And the days are just flooding past.
...shape than we were when we stopped.
That's Gilliam in Lost in La Mancha. It's a documentary about the making of his movie. At this point, shooting has been indefinitely delayed, and he is venting to his crew.
I don't know how one gets out. I mean, not being... Having been in this stuff before, I plowed on, and I don't... I have any energy to plow on at the moment.
This isn't a plowable.
I know that. So I don't know how a plug gets pulled out of a thing like this.
the plug was pulled, and the movie never got finished.
What do you got for me?
Well, I...
On the Beery picture, where are we? What do you got?
Well, I'm having a little trouble getting started.
Getting started? Christ, Jesus, started? You mean you don't have anything yet?
Well, not much.
In the late 1980s, Joel and Ethan Coen were struggling with their screenplay for Miller's Crossing. So to get a little distance, they wrote another movie, Barton Fink, about a playwright who's lured to Hollywood and hits a creative wall.
What the hell do you think this is? Hamlet? Gone with the Wind Ruggles of Red? It's a goddamn B picture. Big men in tights, you know the drill.
I'm afraid I don't really understand that genre. Maybe that's the problem.
Understand, sh-. I thought you were going to consult another writer on this.
That is Tony Shalhoub with John Turturro as Barton Fink.
A lot of productive procrastination is putting off something that's complex, not because you're avoiding it, but because you haven't figured it out yet.
Right.
And working on something else that's still productive while you're, you know, trying to make sense of this creative problem.
Adam Grant teaches organizational psychology at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. He says that what's worse than being a procrastinator is being a goody-goody precrastinator, which is his word for somebody who finishes something way before a deadline, before ideas really get to percolate.
You know, the evidence really bears it out. Your first ideas are usually the most conventional.
Right.
That's why they came first. They were easy to think of.
Do you worry at all that you're encouraging people to feel it's okay just to put things off because they don't want to deal with doing it?
I worry about that pretty much every day.
Oh, good.
I'm not encouraging people to, you know, to go and play Minesweeper when they're procrastinating.
Right.
Right. When we think about procrastination, the dangerous kind is avoidance. You're basically saying, this is hard, so I'm going to do something else. What you want is instead, this is hard, and so I'm going to periodically come back to this to give my unconscious mind time to work it out. A lot of people get paralyzed when they do that because they feel a tremendous amount of self-doubt. A lot of people will say, well, they make this leap from this is crap to I'm crap.
Right.
And I just can't do it. And what you see with successful, you know, originals is they manage that experience by saying, the first few drafts are always crap and I'm just not there yet.
There is one artist who seems to get there faster than anybody else, again and again and again.
I think it's very exciting. Maybe it's analogous to a sports activity where your adrenaline is off and your heart's going a little faster, you know.
That is the writer who makes everybody else on Earth feel like a slacker, Joyce Carol Oates. She's written and published more than 50 novels, plus dozens of books of short fiction and nonfiction. Last year alone, she published 2 novels and a memoir.
I don't feel prolific to myself. I work very hard, and it seems frustrating, and I often can't get anything done in a whole morning. I suppose at the same time, I'm just an average writer for the Victorian era from the 19th century. Dickens was writing very rapidly.
Do you ever hit a dead end as you're doing it, or write something you think, it didn't work out, and throw it away?
Well, I don't write anything till it's ready to be written.
Uh-huh.
I do a lot of thinking. And until I have the whole thing in my head like a movie, I don't really begin.
I wish I had my imagination just unspooling like a movie and I could just write down what it said. But I do have this deadline, which does have its benefits. Like Dr. Johnson said about the gallows, deadlines wonderfully concentrate the mind.
You know, if you're procrastinating on a deadline, you know, it's something that drives us all crazy, but sometimes is necessary to get to something great.
Professor Adam Grant.
Procrastinating without a deadline, that's deadly, right? That's the, I have this big idea and I sat on it for 9 years and
yes.
I never did anything about
yes,
it.
Yes, yeah.
I think deadlines are helpful with knowing when you're done. I'm a fan of the French playwright Molière, who wrote that your work is done not when you have nothing to add, but when you have nothing left to take away. And I feel like I'm close to done when I've removed everything I can and there's nothing I'm willing to let go of.
That seems exactly right to me. Now, I generally write long, sometimes extremely long. So when I get to what I know is the last sentence of the last chapter of my book, that is, a little perversely, just another beginning. I begin to revise, and I begin to cut, and I begin to cut more deeply. Until finally, mercifully, one of those beginnings leads directly to the end.
Just up ahead's the finish line. Two branded referees and two checkered rags. Out of the corner of my eye comes a dark horse with black wings. Ooh, heading for the finish line.
Nobody will watch or certainly want to watch me tapping away at my keyboard over the next few weeks. But when your keyboard is made by Steinway, the creative process can be riveting. Maria Schneider conducts her own jazz orchestra, 18 pieces that sometimes blast like an old big band, but mostly plays music that's more intimate. And she is a hugely ambitious songwriter who takes a kind of classical music approach to composing jazz. Schneider grew up in Windom, Minnesota, population 4,600, and you can hear the Midwestern in her voice. She doesn't put out new albums very often, so when I heard that she was working on one a couple of years ago, I paid a visit to her cozy Manhattan apartment slash studio.
It's called the Thompson Fields, and it's about this farm back home. And I had walked to the top of the silo just a few years back and looking at the bean fields and thinking about all the families that I know, all the
farms. And by beans, we mean soybeans.
Yes, soybeans, yes. and just thinking about the generations and our families and the stories and seeing the wind blow across these beans and just feeling the spirits and the, you know, the layers of life there in the seemingly empty vastness of it all.
Now, how does that, though, when you get back to here, become music?
Well, first of all, when I first start writing something, and I'm this particular song, it first came to me in the laundry room, and it was this. So I'll be sitting here writing something like that or hearing something like that. And all of a sudden, as I'm listening to that, I'm transported to on top of that silo.
Uh-huh.
So this particular piece, if I'm just kind of going through here to see if I can find... eventually this moves on and it goes to the key of A flat. And then this B chord starts happening. And the trombones keep hitting this, but at this point, the pianist, Frank, starts playing. Or maybe in the key of... He starts playing in bitonally against this B to somehow get the feeling of these different things happening. And now what I've got in my head is that maybe I'm going to want the guitar player maybe to start playing an F. I don't know. And then maybe the piano. So that it's almost very Ivesian.
It is.
In its idea.
And when you say you might have the guitarist do this, you don't know yet.
I don't know. I have to talk to him about it, you know, and maybe having him do something with a lot of reverb so it almost feels like there's another tonality in there. I mean, we've been working on this thing for a while, and I'm not quite satisfied yet. So, you know, it's like a work in progress. And the trick is, when you're dealing with improvising musicians, and I want this effect, and I'm not happy until I am sitting on that silo and I am feeling and I am seeing all these families and all these my parents' friends who are gone. When I feel that they're there, then I know we've got it and we don't have it yet. So
yeah.
I have to try to describe what this is that I want.
That's composer Maria Schneider. So was she able to get that piece just right? We followed her for a whole year to find out. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. I'm Kurt Anderson, and you are listening to Studio 360. This is my last show before I go off for a couple of weeks to get done with a book. So this episode is all about the challenges of finishing creative work. And speaking of procrastination,
'cause I'm the tax man. Yes, I'm the tax man.
Tax day, weirdly, April 18th this year, is about a month away. And Studio 360 is approaching that annual deadline creatively with a new listener challenge that we're calling Defile Your Taxes. And I will let our special financially expert guest judge explain.
Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl, the host of Marketplace. Here is some tax advice you're probably not expecting from me. Don't do them, at least not just yet. Instead, I want you to do something really creative with a 1040 form. You could paint or draw on it, or use it for origami or paper mache, or cut them up like snowflakes. Really, anything goes. I'll be picking the winner, and I can't wait to see what you come up with. You have until April 3rd to enter, and you can find out all the details and print out a 1040 form as well at studio360.org/defile.
Kai will be back here to announce a winner on Tax Day. It's hard to know what exactly makes us ready to declare any creative piece of work finished, or what makes us have especially productive runs while we're working, or especially creative ones, those minutes or hours when you feel like you're making a real breakthrough, you're so immersed in what you're doing that everything around you sort of melts away. How does all that work? That is exactly what Heather Berlin researches. She's a cognitive neuroscientist at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City. She studies the neuroscience of imagination and creativity and improvisation. And Heather, thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So one of the reasons we're doing this show now is I've been writing a book for a year and a half, and it's a little later than I'd hoped. And it's kind of the opposite of writer's block. I'm writing too much, actually. But so I have a few weeks left. What would you recommend? More meditation, more walks, just stay at the typewriter 12 hours a day?
Well, it depends on what your exact problem is. So is the problem...
I have no problem, doctor.
Well, what the issue, your concern might be, is it the fact that you have so much to say that you keep writing and you can't seem to stop yourself?
A little.
Or, you know, is it that I don't know how to make it end?
Well, it's more that I began thinking, oh, I've connected these thoughts in my mind. This is only going to take me a year at most. Well, no, a year and a half, and then some.
Yeah. People come in with these grand and great and interesting ideas, and you have to say, well, there's that, and that's really interesting, but there's also the practical aspect is you want something that's going to be feasible to do in this given amount of time that you have.
Right.
And it's very hard when we have our ideas to let go of them.
Right.
But to maybe say, it's okay if I don't touch upon all these things and just let it go.
Not that I want to medicate myself, but what are those medicines that make one more creative theoretically?
I mean, there's really no prescribed medication.
You'd have a good practice if you did that.
Yeah,
though.
I should start thinking about that. There are medications which are called cognitive enhancements that can help you become more productive, but productivity doesn't necessarily correlate with creativity.
Right.
So there is no real magic pill.
Will we get there, though? If we can, we will. Will we?
I mean, some people think that certain psychedelic drugs,
right.
Things like mushrooms.
Yeah.
So you're telling
me to drop acid while I finish this book?
Not acid, but maybe a little mushrooms. Okay. It could, you know, just help you think a little bit outside the box. I mean, whenever you get your brain in a different brain state, you're going to have different types of thoughts, and you might make novel connections that you didn't think of before.
For sure. So when we are being creative, what is happening in the brain, both what you can measure and in general? What do we know about what the brain is doing when we're being creative?
So there are different types of creativity. So we know a little bit about what's happening when you're being spontaneously creative or sort of in the moment improvising. So what you're having is basically an increase in the internal generation of ideas. It's coming from within. You don't need any external stimulus for this. And a decrease in a part of your brain that has to do with your inner critic, your sense of self, your filter system that has to do with making sure that you conform to social norms. So you're in a state of this free flow.
If we can define it a little more narrowly, when a composer is composing or a painter painting or a writer writing.
Yeah, I mean, part of the issue is, you know, how do you define creativity?
Yes.
And that's been one of the kind of blocks for being able to study this phenomena in the lab. But recently, there's been some creative ways that we can look at creativity. And that's by putting artists in an fMRI machine and looking what's happening when they're actually creating something.
Right. But what does that tell us about creativity?
I'll give you an example. Some of the preliminary studies have looked at rappers when they're rapping. So you have a rapper in an fMRI machine doing a memorized piece, and then he's doing an improvised piece.
Yeah. This is your work, right?
This original study was done by Charles Lim and his group, and now we're looking at a larger group of rappers and looking at audience feedback as well. And there was another study which also looked at jazz musicians when they're doing memorized versus improvised playing on a keyboard in a scanner. There seems to be what's emerging is a certain pattern of activation when people are in that improvising state compared to the memorized state. And
the same people doing essentially the same thing, although they're making it up as they go along in one case.
Exactly. So in one case, we show them random images and they have to incorporate
those. Oh, so they have to do improv.
Yeah, exactly. It has to make sense. It has to rhyme. It has to stay on beat. It's quite a complex cognitive task to do. So it involves lots of parts of the brain.
And I get that. And and so what are you finding when they're actually improvising versus just reciting a thing that they've already written?
So what we find is the difference between these two states, the memorized and the improvised states, is that when they're improvising, there tends to be a pattern of activation where they have decreased activation in a part of the brain called the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. And that part of the brain has to do with your sense of self, your sort of inner critic, making sure that your behavior conforms to social norms.
So when they're improvising, that does what differently?
Basically, you lose your sense of self, right? And also that filter, which says, okay, you know, these novel associations, that's not logical. You kind of release your inhibition. The second you become too self-aware, that kind of comes back online and you lose that flow state.
Right.
The other thing was that they had increased activation in a part of the brain called the medial prefrontal cortex. It has to do with the internal generation of ideas. So it's coming from within, combined with this kind of freedom, this lack of inhibition. And together, that can lead to these very creative moments.
And so flow states, when they happen, I mean, is there a range or is it usually a matter of minutes as long as the set lasts or if you're writing for 10 minutes? Because many of us have experienced what we believe to be flow states when we're doing whatever creative work we do. Often you don't know because suddenly, oh, an hour passed. I didn't know that. Is there a range?
It definitely varies. And it doesn't have to just be when you're in the flow state in a creative state. So, for example, if people are engrossed in like rock climbing
or athletic
activity, they can enter this state.
Sex, I suppose.
Yeah, where you lose your sense of self and you do get decreased activation in dorsolateral prefrontal cortex.
That's what I always say during sex.
And right away it takes.
Yeah. Artists of various kinds talk about creative block. Is that a real thing or is that just a kind of catch-all for I'm having a hard time working?
Yeah, I mean, I think it means it's one and the same thing, you know, or, you know, some people when they're in that flow state, it just a lot of people say it feels like it's flowing through me. It's coming from someplace else. You know, it's coming so naturally. I don't even have to think about it. But if you can't get into that flow state and you're too, let's say, cognizant about it. So it's called deliberation without attention. You can only keep a certain number of variables in mind when you're thinking about something consciously. But if you let it go, you actually can come to a greater understanding because the unconscious can do much more complex processing.
Really? So it's like the elves doing the shoemaker's shoes in the middle of the night.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why, I mean, creative people, it's like, you know, okay, you have to take in all the information and then go for a walk, go out, do something else. Because those people sit there and just obsess over thinking about it too much, using your prefrontal cortex, you're actually limiting yourself.
Right.
So letting it go can actually help you get over, let's say, a writer's block or a creative block.
Heather Berlin, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Heather Berlin is a cognitive neuroscientist and assistant professor of psychiatry at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai Hospital. So, how do you get into the zone? Is there some specific ritual or set of rituals you have when you're doing creative work to get focused and stay focused? If so, record a voice memo on your phone and send it to studio360@wnyc.org. Still ahead this hour, the musician Alejandra Deheza thought she found her creative soulmate.
We were just on this roll. It was pure creativity, pure life.
It almost seemed too good to be true. That's coming up in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson, and today we are talking about the challenges of finishing creative work.
This particular song, it first came to me in the laundry room.
Earlier this hour, we listened in on Maria Schneider, the jazz composer, who was in the early stages of composing an album for her jazz orchestra. The process is a complicated one. She relies on her musicians to improvise around musical ideas that she's come up with and help her come up with the solutions that then become part of the finished composition.
I want this effect, and I'm not happy until I am sitting on that silo and I am seeing all these families and all these my parents' friends who are gone. When I feel that they're there, then I know we've got it and we don't have it yet.
She means silo, literally. For her latest album, Schneider took her entire ensemble, more than a dozen musicians, to her tiny hometown in Minnesota so they could just soak up the landscape. Here's her pianist, Frank Kimbrough.
We stayed out at the Thompson Farm. They have room for about half the band to stay there. We can just kind of stretch out at his farm for a day or two. It's beautiful because it's, I think she was referring to it as native prairie.
We had concerts in Wyndham, which were the most fun concerts I ever did because all those people sitting in the audience, it's very moving.
But it's like putting on our town in our town if it were a real place.
Yeah, it is. And there's nothing better than bringing this band to play the music for the people and the home that inspired it. Very moving for me.
So you have almost moments ago finished, I understand.
Yes. Yes. It's a great feeling.
So you mastered it today, whatever that means.
Yes. The final touches on the final version that goes to the factory.
And the title is finally?
It's The Thompson Fields.
As you said it would be a year ago. Well, congratulations. I want to play a clip, actually, from the conversation we had last year. You were talking about the title track, which was still in the incubation stage.
Now what I've got in my head is that maybe I'm going to want the guitar player maybe to start playing an F. I don't know. And then maybe the piano.
And when you say you might have the guitarist do this, you don't know yet.
I don't know. I have to talk to him about it, you know, and maybe having him do something with a lot of reverb so it almost feels like there's another tonality in there.
And so did you talk to that guitarist about adding reverb?
We ended up not using the guitar. That's funny when I was listening to that. It is amazing to look back at your creative process. And I could still add guitar, but we ended up just doing it with the piano. And Frank plays in two keys with his two hands, so I end up with three keys sometimes.
Wow. And do your musicians, as you're composing, ever disagree with you, or are you just the general, yes, ma'am?
Disagree. I don't think so much disagree, but, you know, we discuss things, and, you know, sometimes when you're trying to get to something and figuring out a section and you're all doing it together, I think sometimes for them, occasionally, there's a degree of frustration if they sense that I'm not hearing it yet and they're trying to give it, and they're the ones who are stuck playing it, wondering if I've heard it yet. You know, that can't be easy. And
that sounds like a relationship.
It is.
I mean, like every relationship.
It's a relationship that's been going on with these people for a lot of years now.
I want to play a bit of one of the recordings along the way in this project that you made. And we recorded these in the sound booth, so people will hear the engineers occasionally telling each other to make adjustments. So, is this what we're hearing now, the first time you played that piece in the studio?
In the studio, yes. But it sounds, that's not the take we used. I can tell
Tell me what you're hearing that wasn't quite right, that you wanted to fix in the subsequent takes.
I'm hearing that there's a little bit of a lack of flow in the time. This piece has I wanted to capture some motion, so I think we're all kind of finding our way, and I think that our final version has a little bit more flow to
this it. Isn't enough forward propulsion for you?
Yeah. Yeah, well, here it feels a little weak. Yeah, this definitely isn't the take, but, you know, not bad.
let's hear the final version on this album that you have just signed off on. How does it feel to be done? This is a long process.
Oh, it is. I feel like I am literally crawling on my hands and knees to the finish line. It's a huge project. It was a lot of music and a lot of details. And you put so years into writing it, a lot of time into rehearsing it. I want to represent each soloist in a really good way. And I don't know. I put my heart and soul into these records.
This one more than others, or do they all take this much out of you?
They're all painful, but each subsequent one feels like, oh, it was never this painful before. But then other people remind me that, yes, you cried before, and you know.
And the next album, are you even thinking about that process beginning
next
yet?
Next album, don't even say
sorry,
next
sorry,
album.
Sorry, sorry,
sorry. I don't know. I don't know when I can go through this again. You know, let's see, I made a classical album with Dawn Upshaw 3 years ago or 2 years ago. I don't even know now. And before that, recording my band, it was 8 years ago. Oh, I remember now why I waited so long. Right. It's a lot of work.
So this is the record for this decade.
Yes, it is.
Maria Schneider, thank you so much for letting us annoy you and hang around with you during this entire process. It's been a pleasure for us.
Pleasure for me. Thank you.
Maria Schneider's album is called The Thompson Fields. The next and final story is about how fate can sometimes get in the way when you're trying to finish something. It's the story of a band called School of Seven Bells, and it starts as a love story. In the 2000s, Benjamin Curtis was in a band called Secret Machines. He played guitar. At the same time, Alejandra Deheza was in another band called On Air Library. Ali and Benjamin met when their bands ended up on a tour together, and it really was kismet, like in a movie.
There was just something that hit. It was like lightning, and I knew that we were definitely going to do something together in life, definitely, but also musically. It just kind of immediately went hand in hand.
And that something became their band, School of Seven Bells.
We started working on SVIB the summer of 2012. It was just one of those things where we were just on this roll. And so we just went into the studio every day and spent like 12 hours straight just hanging out, writing music, recording it. We just had so much freedom. We were so happy. So that summer, it was just pure creativity, pure life, pretty much.
Yes.
We had wrapped it up. We had some demos, and we were basically going to tour for the fall. And then he got sick, and in the beginning of 2013, we checked him into the hospital.
My name is Brandon Curtis. I played in the band Secret Machines with my brother Benjamin. I was in Germany, and I got a phone call saying that they were doing a biopsy, but it was to the point where they felt like they needed to start chemo without even getting the results of the biopsy. And a couple of days after that, he was diagnosed with T-cell lymphoblastic lymphoma.
And the minute that he got the diagnosis, they started him on chemo. After that, I think there was like maybe only a few times that he could leave the hospital, just because I honestly don't know what made him more sick, if it was the chemo or if it was the cancer, but you couldn't tell at that point.
He had been living in the hospital for months. We kind of like set up in there, and he had a lot of stuff. He had his laptop and drives and little USB keyboards, and he's like stopped eating, but he was still kind of like spending hours a day in front of his laptop making music.
Confusion was written during his treatment. He just started playing this synth. I'm not sure if I even knew he was recording or not, but we always had a mic set up and everything. So I was just kind of like singing into it, and the whole thing was pretty improvised.
A window open to the wind. Shadows heaved over our dreamy heads. Confusion waves.
I remember it was pretty hard to even get the words out, because we were both crying when we were recording this song.
And I understand nothing of these changes.
It was like this moment that was so incredibly precious to us that we knew it. And we just kept everything as it was. That's how it came out.
Changes, these changes.
When we were leaving that night, the night of his death, kind of packing up, putting stuff together, I was aware that this was important and that there was something to be finished in this bag or in this area, but I didn't have the energy or the inclination to really open it up.
Honestly, it's such a blank to me that time.
We didn't talk about what his idea for the music would be, other than he wanted Ali to have the opportunity to finish it, and he wanted Ali to be in a position to kind of make the record that she wanted to make. And if that were to happen, then he would be happy with it.
I'm Justin Meldal Johnson, and I produced the band School of Seven Bells. Starting up a record again that was essentially in the hands of someone else entirely, who's not around anymore, was a really challenging task. On all previous School of Seven Bells records, Benjamin is the main musical content creator and the producer, so he has a language of his own.
And I also knew that recording the record and finishing it would also go hand in hand with me needing to be ready to talk about it, because I really did want to. I wanted people to hear the story and hear everything that happened to make this record even possible.
Everything was done in Benjamin shorthand, and it was scattered across several hard drives and had very proprietary bits of software that was being used to create it and was very hard to replicate in, say, an entirely different studio environment.
I'd been in the room with him running Pro Tools or Logic and just kind of helping him put microphones in front of speakers. And so I was aware of how things were set up and like the housekeeping aspect of digital recording, labeling files. And so I knew how he was working.
So with the help of Brandon, we basically took it all apart and put it back together again.
Ablaze was one of his favorite songs. He was just like, immediately from the beginning, had this vision for this song. He just always had this like celebration in mind. It was hard to write these lyrics for me, but just when I started writing it, there was so much that I wanted to get out at that particular moment. And I just wanted so much to tell him how much I loved him and how much I still loved him and just what a force he was.
I think that shows a great deal of strength on Allie's part, that she was able to kind of exert her personality onto this thing and still respect Benjamin's.
It's taken this whole time for me to stop asking that question. What would he do here?
I saw someone who had been through the gauntlet come out the other side and have not only her identity intact, but even more fully articulated.
We wrote together for 10 years, so it's been a long process to try to get to the point where I can actually differentiate what my voice is. I feel like I'm figuring that out now, finally.
School of Seven Bells' new record, SVIIB, is out now. Studio 360's Julia Lowry Henderson produced our story. And this edition of Studio 360 about finishing is finished, which is always satisfying. We'll be back with a new show next week, but I'll be working on my book. So in my place, the actor and singer Molly Ringwald will be in this chair hosting. Break a leg, Molly. And you can always find us on Twitter. We're at Studio 360 Show, and I'm at KB Anderson. That's with an E-N. Remember to print out a 1040 tax form and turn it into something else, something cooler, as part of our Defile Your Taxes contest. Find out all you need to know at studio360.org/defile. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our team here includes
Jenny Lawton,
Andrew Adam Newman,
Louis Mitchell,
Matt Frassica,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Krista Ripple,
Karen Chakurji,
Danielle Fox,
Afi Yellowduke,
Kate Essig.
And special thanks this week to Eric Molinsky.
What do you got for me?
Well, I'm having a little trouble getting started.
Started? You mean you don't have anything yet?
Studio 360 is supported by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds at fjc.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360. I'm Molly Ringwald, and I'm taking over the host chair while Kurt's away. I'll talk with some of my very favorite artists, including writer Lauren Groff.
A writer is a writer not because we're good at writing, right? But because we're willing to do it.
That's next time in a special edition of Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.